The point is that I mentioned yesterday that sometimes we have very profound blind spots and we can't actually see what is just too far away from our experience. It reminds me of one of the friends and one of the monks I grew up with. He was a veteran of the Vietnam War. He was a Marine. Some of you may remember him, Ajahn Ananda, a long time ago. He died many years ago. But he came to Australia several times. And if you looked at the back of his head, he had a depression in the back of his head because he volunteered to be a US Marine. He was a bad guy, a tough guy. He was told me he was in these street gangs in one of the provincial towns of New York, where he would say, you know, he'd go around with motorbike chains playing for keeps, so he said. So I don't know exactly what he did, but he was a really terrible character. He volunteered for the army, because that's how you learn to get tougher. So he's a really bad, tough guy. But when he was in a battle in Vietnam, he was supposed to be the radio operator, but one of his friends got what they called the $1 million wound. He got shot in the foot. And this fellow who was about to become a monk a few years later was just sitting laughing at him, saying, "Oh, you're a lucky thing, you know." We didn't actually say lucky thing, but I won't say exactly what he said. But something like that, with that meaning, but in Marine speak. And because the fellow would be cashiered out of the army with a nice pension, and just like a bit of a sore foot, that's all. And as he was saying that, he lost his mindfulness for a few moments, and he got shot in the back of the head. He thought he was going to die. And when he came to in the hospital, being shaven for the first time, it must have been a premonition for something good to come in the future, to heal the wound. The doctors told him he would be blind, because the part of the brain which was injured by the bullet was the part which dealt with sight. But what happened was, after the bandages were taken off, he said that he made a resolution, if that was the case, as soon as he had the ability, he would kill himself, because he didn't want to live a life without sight. And he was a tough guy, he probably would have done it. But as soon as they took the bandages off, he could see. And it was amazing that he prepared himself to be blind and to kill himself. And now, as soon as the bandages were removed, he could actually see, to the surprise of the doctors and obviously his surprise and delight. And that experience gave him a huge, what he called, high for over a year. He had an army pension, honorably discharged, a little hero, and he could just enjoy himself. He had his full health. But then, the reason I tell this story was that one day, you know, not having to work, he was playing baseball with his friends, and he was out there in the field. The batsman hit the ball in his direction. It was an easy catch, and as you would do, you follow the ball into your hands, but as he was following the ball with his eyes, the ball suddenly disappeared. It just vanished from the universe. And that was such a weird and strange thing. He didn't know what was going on. And then, just as suddenly, it reappeared again. And he could catch it. It was the first time he discovered he had a blind spot. Because of the injury with the bullet to the back of his head and the part of the brain which had been removed, he had most of his vision, but there was a spot which was completely wiped out. And in his field of vision, that was like a hole. The point was, he hadn't noticed until that point, because the mind, perception, fills in that hole with what it expects to be there. And it fills it in so well that you just can't see it. You look there, and it's not as if there's a black space there. If you're in a room, the mind just actually continues the line of the rafters, it continues the colour of the ceiling, and it just fills it in as the mind expects should be there. And it's only when your expectations get confounded, in that particular case by a ball which should have been flowing on a continuous trajectory, suddenly disappeared and reappeared again, only then did you realize, my goodness, I have a blind spot. And this is a wonderful simile for what happens in insight practice. There's much of life we have filled in with our desires and our sometimes denial, we blanked out. Things we don't want to see, we will not see. Things we're terrified, afraid of, we just can't see it at all. And things we want to see, we're always, if it's not really there, we will make it up. Which is why in many religions, if you want a miracle, you'll make one up. But to you, it would appear as if it's a real miracle. It's amazing the power of our mind to create the world in a fashion we want it to be. Now, when you understand just how powerful that mind is, and how it can fill in the holes which shouldn't be there, and it can add things which should be there, then you understand just how delusion is a problem which we have to overcome. And I mentioned a couple of days ago that thing which I saw in the What the Bleep Do We Know, about the American Indians could not see those ships which were right in front of you. Imagine looking out onto the sea and there's three blooming big ships in there. You just can't see them because the mind blanks it out. They can't be there. It shouldn't be happening. Therefore, it doesn't happen. Now, this is a problem with finding insight. Insight is more sneaky than you ever imagine. Delusion is very delusory. That's why it's called delusion. We think it's there, but it's not. We can't see it, and it is. So we have to somehow sneak up on delusion to be able to make our minds very powerful and also courageous. It's the courage which is most important, because you know, we are lazy people. Our minds are lazy. We'd rather just stay with the known, the comfortable, even if it's a bit unpleasant. At least we're used to it. We'd rather stay there. It's the old simile of a person who's been born in prison. They were born there, and they've grown up there, and they've never known anything other than prison life. And because they've got a positive attitude, they say, oh, prison isn't all that bad. And some of them say, oh, prison is terrible. And they say, come on, get your act together, be positive. Don't be such a misery guts, go and get some therapy. But the point is, the prison is unpleasant. And sometimes we get in denial, it's not really a prison after all. You know, we could actually paint ourselves, put on some nice music and just try and enjoy ourselves, try and blot out the fact that we're in prison. And this is a problem here. If that's all you've ever known, you think it's okay. But of course there's a whole world beyond that prison. That prison is a simile, for the five senses and the will. The five senses are the five walls of your prison. And the will, the choice, the doer, that is the guard always telling you what to do, prodding you. It is the will which is the torturer, abusing you. Come on, get your act together. Come on, don't be so stupid. Get up early. Do this, do that. It's always a torturer, never giving you any rest. But of course we can't see that because it's always been there. We've always been in prison, so how can we know anything different? So we use the way of insight to try and sneak up on reality, or rather sneak out from your prison. And the only way we do this is using the carrot of joy. Because whenever you have to face something which is uncertain, going in uncharted territory, things where you don't really know whether you can stand it or not, it is joy which is the vehicle which pushes you through. It is like the child who goes to learn swimming for the first time. You may remember when you first were a little toddler and you learned how to swim, or you may have taken your children to the swimming pool or the baths to be able to learn how to swim. Imagine what it's like to be a 4, 5, 6-year-old child. You've only just learned how to walk and actually deal with solid stuff. And now your mother is taking you this wobbly stuff which you can't even hold. She's always slipping through everything which you try and hold it in. It's just such an unsafe, uncertain material, this water business. So no wonder a child is terrified when they see water, they don't know how their little body can stand in it or survive in it. You can't even breathe in it. So how does the parent get the child to learn how to swim? First of all, you say, put your toe in it. And the little child puts a toe in the water and drags it out very quickly. That was nice. Okay, just maybe two toes. So you put two toes in. That's actually very nice and pleasant. Put your whole foot in there. That's fun, splashing it around. Put your whole leg in. Now you're really splashing around. The more you immerse your body in that pool of water, the more fun it becomes. And you see all the other kids in there, splashing around, shrieking, having a great time. That is the incentive for the child. And it goes in. And as soon as it goes in, it's having a wonderful time. It's the joy, the pleasure, the fun, which goes through the fear and overwhelms it. And that's always the way we actually go to uncharted territory. It's the only way we can go into things like nimittas and jhanas, and also into insight, which can sometimes be terrifying. But we can do that because it's such good fun. It's pleasurable, it's delightful, and eventually you just cannot resist it. Surely you've been in prison for many, many years, lifetimes even. So you get a crack in the walls and you see outside. And even though you don't really know what it's like outside of prison, even though that you feel comfortable with all the years you've spent inside jails, you've sort of worked it out, sort of. So it's terrifying going outside. But it's so delightful, it's so attractive, it's so appealing. Eventually you can't resist. It is necessary to have a great deal of joy to do insight meditation. Otherwise, you won't have the strength and the courage to see things which are so deeply challenging in an ordinary state, you would just not be able to do it. I remember one of our monks, I won't tell you his name because he's very well known. When he was on a retreat with me years ago, he was getting into some very deep meditation. He was really sort of going into sort of non-self. And he said he got so close, but he just could not get any deeper. Just the fear, the terror was huge. He was, you know, undermining his own sense of existence. And there's nothing more terrifying than you disappearing. That's the most frightening thing for a human being, is taking away your very existence. They can steal your physical possessions and you get upset if a burglar comes into your house. They can steal your car. And, when they steal your body, and that's a bit worse. But if they steal your mind, that's a peak. You can't get worse than that. Someone taking over your mind. That's why sometimes people's fears are like that. I remember I grew up with the worst thing you could do is sell your soul to the devil. And I've already mentioned that joke. I'd be very happy now if someone made me an offer. But even worse than that is someone taking over your mind. I think they can take it over. There's nothing there to take over. It's what we call in business a shell company. The mind, there's nothing into it. But when that you start to approach that, this is getting a bit too sensitive, which is why insight is so hard. For him, he could get close, but the mind would not allow him to get closer. So the advice was, get some more joy, some more power. And sometimes you get so much joy and power, you just go straight in there. You just can't resist it. It is the joy, the energy of the mind that gives you the power to see what you don't want to see. And in insight, in the pursuit of truth, you have to be that courageous, as they say, to die for the sake of truth. And this is what you are doing. The body, the mind, is disappearing. It is dying. Which is why the Ajahn Chah, in his first year, he used to have these phrases he kept on repeating, these little slogans. Because he kept on repeating it, you'd always remember it. And he kept on telling us, if you come here to die, have you come here to die? It wasn't, it's not the Australian joke, you come here today. This was actually Thai. Now, have you come here to die? And of course, you didn't understand what he meant at first. What do you mean? I want to live. I'm not come here to sort of kill myself. You understood later on what he did mean, because the path of insight has a consequence to it. You disappear. So if you're able to get that insight, sometimes you need a strong mind, a penetrating mind, and that strength and penetration, hopefully that some of you have tasted that degree of power and penetration, when you get deep stillness in your mind. When the mind is still, it does become fearless, courageous, and it has power to penetrate. I remember my preceptor telling me that when he was learning his meditation many, many years ago, this is Somdet Buddhajan, he's now basically acting Sangharaja of Thailand. He was telling that in his early years he learned meditation in the forest, and when he was meditating once, he opened his eyes and there was this big snake on his lap. You know, venomous snake, absolutely sort of poisonous, dangerous. If they bite you, that's it, you're dead. Especially in those days when the anti-venom was a long way away. What was most surprising was when he opened his eyes, he had not the slightest bit of fear. He was just so cool and peaceful. He had this venomous snake there. He can be okay. And he said that normally he would never be able to do that. Normally if he saw such a snake, he would get afraid and run away. The point was, he said, this is what he learned. Just how such a still and peaceful mind meant that fear just did not come up. This is an example of what happens when you have stillness. You get fearless. You can go to places where you don't feel comfortable. So this is how we need to prepare the mind. As the Buddha said, when you develop the peaceful states of meditation, you are abandoning the five hindrances. One of those hindrances is restlessness, and you know one of the causes of restlessness is fear itself. You're afraid to be still in case you might see something you don't want to see. So you get restless and you go through your whole repertoire of distractions, whether it's a cup of tea, whether it's a mobile phone, whether it's writing a book, whether it's fantasizing about writing a book. You have your whole repertoire of distractions which you have used quite successfully throughout your life. Whenever things get a bit rough, you can always get out the favorite TV program on the DVD or the movie you like. We have a repertoire of distractions to avoid seeing the truth of things. But when you get still, you don't have that fear. You don't need to distract yourself. You can actually look directly at reality in front of you as it is, without bending it to suit you. Fear is one of the main causes of restlessness. Fear is one of the main causes why you don't follow the instructions and get still. Half of you wants to, the other half will say, maybe not now. Maybe I don't want to be enlightened. Maybe I'd rather have me here. My family, my possessions. It's not the best, but it's much better than disappearing. Which is why very often when monks give deep talks, people get scared. This is the Buddha actually mentioned this. He said that whenever I give talks on emptiness of non-self, the fact you don't exist, the fact that will is completely conditioned, he said some of my listeners get so terrified they just turn off. And I know that from my own experience too, because sometimes I've given talks, deep talks, and sometimes people haven't been able to sleep that night. They've been terrified because they know that what's being said is true, but it completely overturns their comfortable lifestyle. That's why insight can sometimes be terrifying. So if you have, for example, insight into impermanence, anicca, many people describe it as if you're standing on a platform which is always shifting, that nothing is solid, that you're always continually falling. There's no place for you to maintain balance. Things are always slipping away, and you can't stand still for a moment. It's like continually sliding and falling, never being able to find a foothold or a handhold where you can stay still for a moment. That is terrifying. when you have no place to stand. And sometimes that's what it feels like. Now, I'm just telling you this not to make you more afraid, but to say that the only way that you can confront sort of the profundity and the fear of things like impermanence, non-self, or even suffering is to have such a still mind. It doesn't give a damn. You'll just go for it no matter what. Because the pleasure is just too much. The interest is too strong. You're going to get enlightened despite yourself. You have to overcome those hindrances. It is, I mentioned before, it is desire which bends the truth to suit yourself. Which is why every retreat I say that young men and young girls, they go out and they fall in love at the day, at the night time, when it is nice and dark so you can't see what you're going out with. Even if it's during the daytime, you have to wear lots of makeup, so again you can't see what you're really going out with, and scent to cover up all the bad odours or deodorant, whatever else you have to wear. And what is it, padded bras, false hair, eyelashes. It's amazing just how much false stuff has to go on before you become attractive. So the problem is, you know, that it's all, why do we do that? And why does everybody know what's going on, but we are blind to that? We're determined to be blind because we want to have our girlfriend look beautiful. And so we play along with it if you're a boy. And if you're a girl, you want your boyfriend to look really strong and handsome or whatever. So you go along with all his dye and his hair and everything else which he puts on his face as well. And the thing is, it's desire. We want this to happen. Creates a delusion. We refuse to see what's really there. We don't want to see what's truly there because we want to live in the delusion. This desire maintains the delusion because we want it to be that way. And we also have the ill will as well. We will not see what we just don't want to see. If you had an argument with your husband, especially if you've been divorced, you can never see anything good in that guy. And you wondered why you ever married him. What did you ever see in such a pig? Because that's what it looks like when you're angry. Any redeeming qualities, any good things in that person. Look at the way that Mr. Bush looks at Osama bin Laden. Any redeeming features in that person, Mr. Bush will not see. He cannot see. There's no way he can see it. But there are many redeeming qualities there. No human being is all bad. However you might think they are, that's because you've got ill will. It is things like ill will and desire bend the truth to suit us. We're seeing not what's there, but what we want to see. So insight will never happen once those hindrances are there. Those hindrances bend the truth to suit you. So if you want to be a Christian, you can believe in God and you can see all the evidence. It's so clear that Jesus exists. I can't see why everyone else can't see it. You know why? It's because you have that hindrances. It's bending the truth to suit your own views. And what comes to your vision, to your senses, is just what you want to see. And that's what's there, and it becomes quite obvious to you. If you're a Hindu, it's quite obvious that Hinduism is the best religion. If you're a Muslim, you can't understand why other people just cannot see it. It's great to actually to understand why there's such a diversity of views and everyone thinks they're 100% right. Once you start to see the work of the hindrances, how they bend the truth and reality to suit yourself, you understand that they are the big problem. What you're experiencing, what you're seeing, is not what's there. It's been filtered and washed. It's what you want to see. What you don't want to see has been thrown out before it even comes to your conscious awareness. When you understand that, you understand just how untrustworthy your senses can be. Which is why that if ever you're sitting meditation and you do see a series of numbers, you cannot trust it. If you see another vision, you cannot trust it. Whatever you see in those beginning parts of meditation are completely untrustworthy. Because sometimes you might see visions of demons. I got to mention this because this is a problem in your meditation sometimes. You may be sitting there and this demon comes right in front of you. Because I remember this one lady in Perth some years ago said she was meditating and she got in a quite peaceful state and she saw this devil in front of her. And the devil spoke to her, "I've come to take over your mind." She came out of her meditation really quickly. And he couldn't wait to get to the monastery to speak to me. Ajahn Brahm, help, help, help. It was a real experience. She hadn't imagined it. It's just one of these things which happen in meditation. This demon, "I've come to take over your mind." So, what did I say? Actually, I recall that, yeah, I had something similar many, many years ago as a monk. No, I was a monk, nothing, I was even a lay meditator. So I don't know, maybe in the early years as a monk or late years as a lay meditator. I'm meditating there and I got this demon came up to me. And I had full vision. You know, the whole works with these fangs dripping blood and these big bulging eyes, you know, really mean and nasty. And it's like skulls around his head and spiky hair. And I forget what else it had, but it looked really mean and nasty. I recognised it straight away, because if you've ever been in those, especially those Tibetan temples, they have this big sort of carved sort of, that was the guy. But I also had enough knowledge and insight of meditation to know that I was creating this. I know how the mind creates. So the insight was, this was the creation of my mind, and so I can actually mess around with this. So, just as I used to do on the school textbooks, I blacked out a couple of the fangs. So it, you know, it looked like it needed to go to see the dentist quick. And I put a cigarette in the corner of its mouth, so it was dragging on this fag. Instead of these big, bulging, scary eyes, I put these Ray-Bans on them, these sunshades. And to finish it off, I put this big straw hat on it with a flower coming out. And the last thing I did, the corners of its mouth I pushed up into a smile. And this demon looked so crazy, so funny, that I ended up laughing in my meditation. I humiliated that demon. And it never came back again. I realized these are the creations of the mind. And obviously I'd created that because I was in a mood of fear. And I countered that fear with joy, playing around with the images in my mind. So, you know, recently someone came and told me they were in my monastery on a retreat and they were seeing demons on the floor. I said, "Do that, doodle with them, put straw hats on them," and they did that, and the demons just completely faded away. You're creating these, you can do something with them. They come from the defilements, they come from the hindrances. You're bending reality to suit yourself. You can bend it the other way as well. It's not that hard to do. And with that lady who thought that that demon was going to come and take over her mind, I told her to listen. It's like a burglar coming to your house and saying, "Excuse me, madam, I'm going to come and rob you tonight." No burglar would do that. If that was a real demon and they were going to come and take over your mind, they wouldn't announce it, they'd just do it. So if they're telling you that, you know it's not a real demon. And that sort of satisfied her, and of course it never came again. The point is that when we have these hindrances, they always bend the truth to suit us. And we cannot trust them. When it comes to the pursuit of truth, the arising of insight, real understanding and knowledge, the only thing we can trust is a mind which is free from the hindrances. When you have courage, no restlessness, there's no desire there, there's no wanting anything. Whatever comes, you'll look at it as it is, without bending the truth. And you're not in any type of denial, no ill will. You are completely open to seeing things as they truly are. That is a very rare state. So rare that if you read the Buddha's teachings, you see that the whole purpose of meditation, it seems quite obvious when you read these suttas, is to somehow overcome those five hindrances. To give you a window of opportunity to see the Dhamma. Clearing that window from grime and dust so you can fully see what's outside beyond your prison. That's what you do. That's what insight is. Before you have insight, you have to clean the windows of your mind from the five hindrances. And this is what happens. You clean those windows, you get into these deep meditations, and you see things you've never seen before. Your blind spots are taken away. What you see when you get into those deep meditations, and this becomes the what you call the 13, 14, 15, 16 stages of Anapanasati, you start to see anicca, impermanence. Now many people think they understand what impermanence is. So much so that if they ever do any contemplations, that's probably the last one they do, because they think they already know that. You know that life is impermanent, everything changes, nothing stays the same. Superficially we do. We don't know the deep stages of impermanence. The word anicca does not mean rise and fall. That is just a superficial explanation or definition. As a young monk, I taught myself Pali. I taught it according to Professor Walder's book, where he said the best way is just to learn some basic stuff, but then just go and read the suttas and the Vinaya yourself. And through reading, you'll notice the meaning of those words. In the same way, you can understand whether English or any other language by a lot of reading and seeing how those words are used in context again and again and again. You get a feel for those words, you understand their meaning. You understand how they were used by the people who spoke them. That's what I did. And when you start to look at the word anicca, you realize it doesn't mean rise and fall in the time of the Buddha. What anicca meant, you find this out from its opposite. They have another word, the opposite is called nicca. Nicca means regular, certain. Any person who would say, bring food to the nuns' monastery every Tuesday, that would be called nicca food, a regular supply of food. When what is regular, always happening, disappears, that is called anicca. What was always there, regular, continuous, now disappears. Now when you understand this, you realize that what is always there, you don't see, you don't hear, you can't feel, because your brain, your sensory apparatus, is only sensitive to things which fluctuate. If there was a constant sound, you would not hear it. A constant feeling, you would not feel it. The reason is, it's always been there. You just don't know. In meditation, something which has always been there suddenly, inexplicably vanishes. That's what anicca means. The regular five senses, which are always there. Sometimes you think they're not there, but their echoes are still there. They're still available for you. You live in that world. When you get to the nimitta and the jhanas especially, what was always there has now vanished. This is a frightening experience. That's why I say it's terrifying, but it's true. It is, I gave this simile many years ago, it is like watching your TV. And your TV has five channels on it. Sight channel, sound channel, smell channel, taste channel, and touch channel, the five channels of your TV. And you can turn the TV off, but you've got the emptiness channel, but it's not really the end of the five senses yet, because you can just turn them on again at the push of a remote. But one day, you're watching your TV, and you think you're doing insight meditation by just seeing the change of the programs, the change of the channels. Now that's just superficial insight meditation. You just see, you know, one TV show change, and then the news come on, and then a sort of a documentary come on, and then a, a movie come on, and that's what most people understand as insight meditation, just see the different channels changing. But what happens in the deep insight is there you are watching your TV called your body and mind, and then suddenly, without warning, your TV set completely vanishes. It's gone. It's not as if the program is gone, the whole screen is gone, and all the electronics and the knobs and even the remote completely vanish from existence. Of course, that is shocking and terrifying. You think, am I going crazy? Am I going mad? What's happening here? TV sets aren't supposed to vanish. If you look in the warranty, it's not covered by the insurance. Now this is exactly precisely what happens in the deep meditations. What disappears is your five senses. Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch disappears in a way you've never imagined before. They are completely inaccessible to you. You can't hear. You can't feel the body. And if you went looking for it, you will not find it. Some of you had a taste of that when your hands disappear or your hair disappeared. Your body sort of disappeared, but if you look for it, you could find it. But in the deep meditations, it's completely gone. You can't find it. You can't see. You can't hear. And that's why that sometimes it gets really good fun when you get into such deep meditation that people call you. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, you just can't hear them. You hear the dong of the bell, you just don't know. In one of my recent retreats, that happened to someone. They didn't know we finished the retreat. They were still meditating. Have a wonderful time. That happened to this novice in this story, in Wat Bapong, in Ajahn Chah's time. He was meditating. No, he wasn't meditating. It was in the evening, Ajahn Chah was giving a talk, and it was a boring talk. For those of you who think Ajahn Chah was a great teacher, he was sometimes, but most of the time he was as boring as hell. More boring than a politician. And I can say that because he was my teacher and I respect him enormously. The point was, he would sometimes give a talk for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. Sometimes all night he'd go on. But every now and again he'd say something interesting, something really profound, and that's what we always remembered. That's what got in the books. All the other stuff got filtered out. But the real was really boring. And sometimes he'd just go on and on and on and on. And this was one of those evenings. He was going on and on, hour after hour, with really boring, uninspiring, dull, tedious stuff. And there was this poor little novice who was listening, having to listen. He had no choice. He had to be there. He was only a small novice. He needed to go to bed. It was all right for these old guys. They didn't need to sleep. They're probably insomniacs anyway. But he was a small guy, and he needed his sleep. And when it got to 10, 11 o'clock, he was getting really upset. When it got to 12 or 1 o'clock, you could see he was just fuming. And all the time he was thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? And you probably understand this, because sometimes you get into this rut in your mind, like these words just keep repeating themselves over and over, you just can't get rid of them. And that became like a rut. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? Hour after hour, and he's really getting fed up with this Ajahn Chah, and always thinking, when am I going to stop? And then he had his insight. This little novice, an insight, seeing things in a slightly different way, that's all you need to do. His insight was, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When am I going to stop? Because you know, Ajahn Chah was yak, 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 and he noticed he was yak, yak, yak. This novice was yakking to himself, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And he only thought that once, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. The little novice stopped. And when he opened his eyes, Ajahn Chah had finished his talk a long time ago. The whole hall was empty. He just got into this beautiful state of meditation. And all the monks had come and they'd gone. And it was something early in the morning. They just left him there to enjoy his meditation. The first time he got into a deep meditation. Because he'd stopped. Let go. Stop. That's a great thing to do. But the point was, the reason I mentioned that story, is that he couldn't hear anything, couldn't feel anything, didn't know what was going on. But having, not outside anyway, but having a great time inside. And when you come out from those states, you can't forget them. Not only have you the powerful mind freed from the hindrances, that you can actually look at something which is very terrifying to the ordinary person, but you also have the data, the strange and weird experience of anicca, of seeing something which was always there, is no longer there. Then you understand what the senses are. The other simile which I use, and I haven't found a better one, is the simile of the tadpole and the frog. A tadpole born in the water, lived all its life in the water, cannot understand what water is. It's always been there. In the same way, if you've always had the five senses, you just cannot understand what these five senses really are. The other frog says that water's wet. So what do you mean it's wet? What is wet anyway? If it's always been there, you just can't know what wetness is. In the same way that the monks, the nuns, the teachers, the Buddha says the five senses are a bunch of suffering. What are you talking about? It's not suffering. What do you mean suffering? What is this suffering word? Like the tadpole, what is this wet word? What does it mean? And one day the tadpole turns into a frog. And it turns into a princess, but that's the wrong metaphor. One day, the tadpole turns into a frog and it hops out of the pond and it's on dry land. Now, once it's completely moved away from the area where it's lived all its life, it's got a completely new experience, and it's terrifying for a frog the first time it hops out. But once it's done that, only then can it realize what water is, once it's left. In the same way, the only way you can understand what the senses are and how much suffering they are is when they disappear. You're a frog. You got into a jhana. You left the world of the senses. Then you understand why these five senses are a whole bunch of suffering, and they don't belong to me anyway. They're these five walls which have kept me in jail for all these years. You have the data, the experience, and you have the mind which can understand it. You've also had the teachings of the Buddha. You understand the language to describe it to yourself. First noble truths about suffering. You understand these five senses are suffering. The best sex, the best music, the best food, the best sunset, seeing a baby born, whatever it is, you think's the best experience. Now you know just how much it is all suffering. You found another world. This is an insight which changes you. It means you get detached from the five senses. But that's not all that disappears. As you go into the jhanas, even the first jhana, there's something else disappears. Something which has always been there. So much that you take it as obvious that that's you. That is your will. Your ability to choose. Especially when you enter the second jhana and beyond, there the will is completely absent. Even the potential to do has gone. And again, I don't mean that you just suspend the will by an act of will. It is completely beyond you. It is not there. You cannot suddenly turn it on. You cannot access it. You can't do anything. It has disappeared, vanished, kaput. Now that is weird and strange. It would usually sort of terrify you, but you are so blissed out. You're just enjoying every moment, and that is holding your mind in this experience of no will. When you emerge afterwards, you can't help but understand that this thing you call choice and will, it can disappear, it can vanish. You've experienced like a tadpole going out of the lake. Now you know what choice, what will truly is. when it's always there, you just don't know it. When it disappears, then you can understand what it is. You get your perspective. This is such an important insight, because too many of us control our life. We attach to our will. We think that's us. And that's why we get really disappointed when we do things wrong. That's why we do attach to our bad karma and our good karma. And we get reborn accordingly. You can let go of your bad karma. You are not a prisoner of it. And the Buddha said you are born of your karma, heir to your karma. That's only when you don't know any better. That's talking to ordinary people. The arahats are free from their karma. They've disinherited their past. Or in the future as well. You've let go. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Because I said yesterday, you've got so much bad karma from the past. Each one of you, me included, and sister, and all the monks especially. They've got so much bad karma, we will never be able to pay it off. It's one of these debts which are just unpayable. Nor can we ever exhaust the store of good karma we have from all the wonderful things we've done. That's why samsara is endless, if we want to go according to karma. But we can disinherit the whole lot. We can let it go. When we see that will, and this is Buddha, the Buddha actually said that chetana is karma. Chedana han karmang vadami in the Sanyutta. Will is karma. So when you let go of will, you're letting go of karma as well. You're free. But that's a difficult thing. You can't do that through an act of will. All you do is actually to see that. When you leave the world of the five senses, when you leave the will behind, when you're in that state, because the will is not there, that is why it's absolutely still, immovable, like a rock. That's why we call those rock-like samadhis. Second jhana is called by the Buddha the fulfillment of samadhi. The reason why it's fulfilled is because at that point, nothing can shake you. It can't even make you tremble. You're absolutely still. You can't do anything. You can't think anything. You can't move. You can't decide to go left or right, to come out, to stay in. You can't do anything. Will is completely removed. And these are great experiences for people to have. Once they have these experiences, they understand what the Buddha's talking about. The tadpole has finally got out of the lake and understands why all these holy frogs, who sometimes live in the lake, sometimes go out on land, what they're talking about. The whole Dharma suddenly becomes clear to you. You get insights. Not insights based on thinking. Not insights based on superficially looking at the ordinary world where everyone else lives, but getting some new data which is accessible to everybody, which completely undermines the way you usually look at life. You see that you aren't in control. There's no one in there who is pushing the buttons. You may scratch your hair, Sue, but you did not do that. You may laugh, Angie, but it wasn't Angie inside who decided that. Whatever you do is all coming from this whole sequence of causes from the past. You are not the one who does. What's the consequence of that? It's a huge freedom from, say, karma. It's also the whole freedom from craving. What is craving anyway, but like a stupid will, which wants this and wants that? Well, you know there's no one in here. There's no point willing anymore. The old simile which I gave years ago, I just after my 17th Rains retreat, I remember it, well, that's 32 now, about 14, 15 years ago. This is the old simile of the driverless bus, but it's one of the classics which came to me once. The driverless bus simile goes like this, if you haven't heard it before. Life is like a bus journey. That's an old metaphor. But I changed it around because sometimes your bus journey goes through some wonderful times. Just like in this retreat, you've had some great days. And you think, why can't it last longer? Can't I sort of slow down and enjoy the beautiful meditations which I had? And why do they just go so quickly? And there's other times your buzz goes through some terrible times. Sometimes you feel so crazy in this retreat, you wonder what you're here for, and you go to the have a cup of tea, it's not enough. You go to the bedroom, you just, that's not good enough. You go and have a talk with me, that doesn't help. Whatever happens, it's just yucky all the way through, and it just stays and stays and stays, and you just can't do anything with it. That's like your buzz going through terrible territory, and it lingers there. And you wonder, why can't my buzz driver get me out quicker? When I'm having a good time, why can't my buzz driver, the will, slow down and just enjoy every moment of this? A lot of you are meditating to try and teach your bus driver how to drive the bus better, so you can have more happiness and less suffering. That's what you're here for. You just want to make life better. Control it more skillfully. But to be able to train the bus driver, you've got to find it first of all. What is this will? Because once you've found the will, you can teach it. Now look, when I'm having happiness, slow down. This is what you should do. Nice happy times, just let go a little bit. And do some nice loving kindness. Slow down, enjoy. If life is getting bad, then they have all these strategies, okay? You can do like any child, this too will pass. Or, you know, just go and take a rest. Or whatever else you do. You have all these strategies. You want to tell your bus driver what to do. You know all these things which I've taught you, but you haven't been able to do them yet. Because your bus driver is just so stubborn and so dense and stupid. I've told you how to meditate, you know, since the very first day. How many of you have been able to do it? Because your will is just so stupid and stubborn, it just will not conform. So you find that will, and this is where you find it in deep meditation. You go into the deep meditations to find the source of the doer. Where does it live? Who is thinking? Who is asking that question? Who is listening to that question? You go right to the center of the doer, the power behind you, the origin of the force. What moves you? What makes you twitch? And you find the bus driver's seat. In the jhanas, you come face to face with the bus driver's seat, the source of the will, the origin of all that moves and shakes and motivates you. And there you see the seat is empty. There's no one there. The empty bus driver's seat. That is not what you expected. You expected to find something there. Something you could teach, something you could control, something you could instruct to be wise and not mess around in future. But when you find your bus driver's seat is empty, wow, you're at least a stream winner, if not more. Because once you see the bus driver's seat is empty, the only thing you can do is to go back to your seat, sit down and stop complaining. How many of you are complainers? My back hurts. I don't want my back to hurt. I don't want my head to hurt. I don't want to feel tired. I don't want to have a restless mind. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be anywhere else. I don't want to have my husband, but I can't live without my husband. I don't want to have kids, but I've got kids. I don't want to have death, but I've got death. I don't want to hear all this. When you see your bus driver's seat is empty, who the hell can you complain to? There's no one there. Bus driver is just empty. You're on automatic pilot. When you see that, it's a waste of time complaining. Things just meant to be this way. People are meant to make noises at night. Toilets are meant to flush. That's what the handle's there for. People are meant to fart, especially the ones sitting right in front of you. This is just a lie. And you are meant to get stupid meditation sometimes, and then beautiful meditation sometimes, and it's nothing to do with you. You're completely out of control. If you don't know that yet, then what have you been doing all your life? Hasn't it been telling you that life is out of control? You've been struggling to control it. Sometimes you've succeeded slightly, and it's given you the illusion you are actually in control. When you see in deep meditation, you realize you're out of control. There's no one there. You're just a bundle of cause and effects. That's all there is there. Why don't you see that? Again, you start complaining. It means the ending of craving. Nice territory. It's par for the course. Terrible territory, having pain, and life is suffering, things are going wrong. What do you expect? That's what life is. What goes wrong? Other half of life goes right. Then it goes wrong, then it goes right again. Then it goes wrong, then it goes right again. Welcome to life. This is it. Do you agree with me? Is that what your life is like? That's what my life is like. I think that's what everyone's life is like. But sometimes you think that you're not doing it right. That's why it's that way. But you are doing everything right. So you might as well shut up. Be quiet. Just enjoy yourself. So you just sit down. And it's wonderful being able to sit down, not having to worry anymore. That's why it's just like being in an aircraft. Say going to Singapore. You just sit down. You can't do anything. Just sit down there and just enjoy, meditate or watch a movie, whatever you want to do. Enjoy the insight service, as they say. Now sit down and enjoy the insight service, they say, the PA system. You can might go up to the captain and say, please go faster, I'm in a hurry, I've got to get to Singapore on time because you left late. And the pilot's not going to listen to you. Or you can say, look, I've got lots of time here. I always wanted to go and see Borod Podor. On your way to Singapore, can you just go low around Borod Podor so I can see it. I'm on the wrong side of the airport, so I can just make the detour around so I can see it. And of course the captain's not going to do that. You have got absolutely no control once you're in that aircraft. Ever since you've been born, you've been on this aircraft called your body, going to its destination called death, and you really haven't got much control. Actually, you haven't got any control. Cause and effect, that's all it is. So what happens when you see that? You let go. No more craving. Peace at last. What happens when you see non-self? That's why the Buddha kept on saying that is the insight to get. See, there's no one in here. But I don't want to disappear. I want to be. And that's one of the biggest cravings of all. And it's fierce, and the biggest terror you can possibly get is to give up yourself. You can't just do that through an act of will. Sometimes people say, I don't want to get reborn again. But they can't just do that through an act of will, because the will creates more karma. You will get reborn again. If you want not to get reborn again, they call that vibhavadanha, the craving not to be. It's still a craving, it's a will. You're still adding fuel to the fire. Life is still going on. Whether you like it or not, you will get reborn. But when you let go of the will, when you disappear, it doesn't belong to me anymore. No one in here. As the Buddha said, it's just like the twigs and the leaves in the monastery. If someone takes up those twigs and leaves, puts them in a pile and burns them, and when they have the ashes, they throw the ashes to the four winds. Monks, would you be upset? No, of course not. It's only twigs and leaves. Worthless stuff. Doesn't belong to us. Precisely, monks. So, if the lay people took up your body and mind, put it on a big fire, burnt not just your body but your mind to ashes, and threw it to the four winds, would you be upset, monks? Maybe. But they understood what the Buddha was saying. When you can treat your body and mind just like the twigs and leaves in the garden outside, not belonging to you, but just the parts of nature, then you know what enlightenment is. You've let go. You're free. There's no one left. That is what deep insight is. And that's what creates enlightenment. Can only be got through the experience of the jhanas, which show you things disappearing, which weren't supposed to disappear. Things which you simply just could not see. Only when you have the mind which is powerful and courageous enough to actually take up those experiences and see what they truly mean. And lastly, the consequence of that is the utter freedom, the ending of rebirth. Gone. That's deep insight. So, questions, yeah? The state of the nimitta. If it really is a full nimitta, then you can't sort of feel the body anymore. Body has disappeared. And you'll notice afterwards you were not able to hear any sounds at that time. However, there is that state. The nimitta is starting to establish itself. So the five senses are pretty much subdued, but they can still sort of come in. So you still hear a little thing, a few things, maybe feel a few things, but most of the time you're with the nimitta. But it's when the nimitta gets strong and stable. You can't hear anything or feel anything. And that's on the edge of the jhanas. Committing into the jhanas is actually committing to leave those. Those five senses are like put down, but they're next to you in the sort of the nimitta stage. In the jhanas, you just move completely away. So they're not within arm's reach, so to speak. So in the jhanas, you're away from the five senses. That's actually why they say the first description of the first jhana in the by the Buddha was vivicheva kamehi. Vivicha means, it's the same word as like viveka. It's the same root. Viveka means like, you know, you're on seclusion. Like you go to the monasteries, you know, you're away from home, you're actually secluded from your house, from your business, from all your stuff. You're not just next door, you're away from it. That's called seclusion. And this is what the Buddha said. Vivicheva, ewa is an intensifier, means really secluded from the five senses, which is the meaning of karma. This is a different, not karma, K-A-double-M-A, K-long-A-M-A. What many people know from its Sanskrit form, which has been immortalized for our sensual world in the Karma Sutra. And that's like, now the karma is this five senses business. That's, you know, for that's the Hindu treatise on sex or whatever. But you know, this is karma. You're secluded from all of that. The five senses are completely done. Gamya. That's right. Yes, but it doesn't mean that in the original party. That's just one example of sensuality. But the word karma means just the whole world of the five senses in all of its modes of very pleasurable, very unpleasant. The whole lot, not just the pleasurable part. So the first jhana, you've lost the five senses of God. So you're away, you're out from the prison. You're on parole, temporary release. You go back again afterwards, but at least you know what it's like outside. In the second jhana, the world is gone. First jhana is like the prison officer, the one who controls you. So just, you know, it's let you outside, but it's still close by. But in the second jhana, you're away. No prison guards, completely free. Why that? It's deep in. I mentioned this in my little booklet on opening the door of your heart. And sometimes people think that some of those statements in there are superficial, they're just like throwaway lines, but some of them are incredibly profound. And one of them is the two types of freedom, the freedom of desire. That is not freedom at all, but the freedom from desire, that's true freedom. When there's no desire, no will left. We think that freedom is I can do what I want, but you can never do what you want anyway. The world doesn't allow it. But we think that's freedom. I just do what I want. The best freedom is there's no wanting at all. It's the freedom from desire, not the freedom of desire. And that's what you experience in the deep meditations. The bliss of the second jhana is very much the bliss of that type of freedom. At last, I don't need to want anything anymore. my will is completely subdued. It's not there anymore. At last I have some peace. The peace from the interfering will. Yes, Moon. Yeah? Why do some people go through jhanas and not get enlightened? Because sometimes they haven't gone through enough jhanas. And sometimes they haven't got sort of the teaching to actually understand what it means. Because ever since I've been teaching these things, every now and again you get people come up and say, it's amazing, because I had that experience when I was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And, you know, you may have been a meditator and told the teacher, and the teacher said, oh, just let it go, just be mindful, or whatever else, and just, because they didn't understand what it was. And so you just neglected, you didn't even think about it or contemplate it. Other people have had that spontaneously when they were lay people. They didn't know what it was at all, but they could never forget it. And as soon as they hear me say, that's what I had, that's what happened, and now at least I understand roughly what it is. But what you need to do next is to actually understand it, to have some framework to analyze it. Things like the Four Noble Truths, which is why the Buddha said that to get stream winning, this is actually one of the questions the other night, to actually to get the first understanding of non-self, it comes for two reasons, two causes. It's yoni samana sikara, which is work of the mind that goes back to the source. Sometimes it is erroneously translated or misleadingly translated as, like, what's it called, a proper attention, what's usual, wise attention. Which, you know, what does that mean? If you analyze the meaning, that just doesn't mean very much at all, because we're always attentive. What do you mean by wise? Everyone thinks they're wise. But what it really means, you know, if you look at the Pali words, it means manasikara, means literally work of the mind. And yoni is the word for a womb. It literally means work of the mind, which goes back to the origin of things, the source of things, the cause of things. And this is what you do in your meditation. You go to the source of the will, the source of the mind, and that's only in jhanas. Yoni samana sikara literally means doing those jhanas. And the other factor is paratagosa, the words of another, and that means the words of an Aryan, someone who's also seen the Dhamma. You can explain those experiences in ways that you can understand what it really means. It is not the words of an Aryan, the words of a Buddha. Words of an Aryan are better because they can explain it to you in new ways, contemporary ways, backwards and forwards, until you can understand what those experiences truly mean. With those two, you have the map, what I call the Paratagosa is the map which you get from someone else who's been on that territory. And the Yonisamana Sikara is like the flashlight. When you have both of those, you find the treasure. If you only have the flashlight, the deep jhanas, you may have actually passed over the territory. You've actually seen non-self, but you can't figure it out. You need a map as well. And the map is called the teachings of the Buddha. That's why the Buddha taught jhana and then taught the Dhamma. If you have both, then you get enlightened. Make sense? Yes, certainly. You can't see it without getting into a jhana. You can think you can see it, you can contemplate it, you can analyze it, you can write a PhD thesis on it, but that doesn't make you a doctor, it doesn't make you an Aryan. Have to see it. These are experiences, and this is why they blow you away. You have these things and people are just wobbling all over the place in the retreat center. Oh, it's so wonderful, because they've just seen something very profound and wonderful. Not just for the sake of seeing something profound, but it's just so pregnant with the deepest of insights. The frog is now standing on land outside of the pond. Now it can actually see. I was over there first of all, then Abby, yeah? Of course you get stuck in there, but eventually you come out again, because it's not your will. Will arises later according to its causes. When the causes of those deep jhanas are sort of subdued, you don't subdue them, they just pass by themselves. They too are anicca. Then the jhana stops and you emerge back again. But if you have the insight that you see will arise, but it is not you doing will. You see the intention coming and going, but no longer do you think that's me behind this intention. We're not saying that will stops and you're frozen for the rest of eternity. What you're saying in the jhana is that will is frozen temporarily, and when you come out afterwards you understand what will truly is. It does not come from a me. So you had no choice but to ask that question. You think that you decided to scratch your eyebrow, but you didn't really have any choice. If it's a very deep jhana, sometimes they say days, sometimes 7 days. That's what they said in the suttas, 7 days at most. But I don't know, they have anecdotal evidence of some people going for much longer than 7 days, not moving. Yes, John. Oh no, Adi was next then, John. Oh yeah, wasn't that deep? Yeah. 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 Ah, because when you're very still, because I was playing with it. So in that sense, there was a sense I was engaging with it. So I was engaging it with an interesting way. Like, always be playful in your meditation. But you know me a long time, Angie, and I am a playful monk sometimes. I keep within the bounds of my vinaya. But you know, you keep a little bit of playful, like when I say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Having that bit of playfulness is important for insight. In that time it didn't stop at all. It was still there. I could still do things. But this was not in the jhanas, this was before those things. Those type of nimittas, they're complex things. They happen before the stage of the full nimitta. You can't do anything. Stops. Oh no, those images of demons never happen in a jhana. This is prior, before jhana, pre-jhana. It's actually pre-nimitta. It's a type of nimitta, but a complex nimitta. So it's early on. It's not in the jhana yet. Aha, okay. In the deep states of meditation, in the jhanas, then you're aware without being able to move. And you can't make sense of what you're experiencing. This is another weird part of the jhana experience. It's like, because I meant the only simile, when I was a kid you had to have these TV programs, they were quiz programs, and at the end of the program they put a picture on the screen and it was an object, an everyday object, and you had to guess what it was and write in, and they would tell you what the object was next week. And if you got it right, you get a prize. I remember one of the objects was like just a pencil, but looked end on. A little black spot with a white ring around it and nothing else. And the whole point of that, what I remember from that exercise, was to be able to comprehend something like a pen, you have to move it around, look at it from different angles, actually to see the full thing, to get perspective.